Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. This week, I'm bringing you an interview with the jazz fusion guitarist, Steve Kahn, who is actually the son of Sammy Kahn, the famous lyricist who wrote songs for such classic acts as Doris Day, Frank Sinatra, and Dean Martin. So we started out talking about his upbringing in L.A.
Growing up with a famous father in music is... You know, is a I don't know. It's a really different thing. And one of the great things that my father, my parents did is growing up in Los Angeles, my sister and I, you know, we went to all public schools. I mean, some people think, well, you grow up with a famous father that you're going to these goofy private schools and stuff. But again, this was the 50s, so the things were really different then, and public schools were really great. And you know, as I sit here today, I think one of the reasons that I can speak reasonably well and write reasonably well is because of stuff I learned, from grammar school through high school. Almost everything useful that I use every day, comes from that part of my education. The name of my high school is University High School. And the other people who've sort of done well in music or, the arts, Jeff Bridges was in my sister's grade. My sister's 2 years younger than me. Jeff and I are still in touch with each other. And Bonnie Raitt was also in my sister's grade. You know, it was just an average, public high school. My father, I think he's a typical product of, being a son of Jewish immigrants and, growing up really poor on the Lower East Side of New York. You know, for him, I think he wanted me to do everything that he wasn't able to do. My father never graduated high school, so education was huge for him, like high school degree, college degree. Those were just like really big things for him. But he also wanted me to, in a lot of ways, he shoved me at the piano when I was like 5 years old, and he made me play, till I was 12. And I really, all I wanted to do was, hang with my friends and go outside and play sports and stuff. So I really hated it. I had one of those teachers, if you make a mistake, she'd rap you on the knuckles with a ruler. I didn't like it. And I think the unfortunate part of my experience, which, was with classical music, was that to get myself out of the lessons and outdoors, I became a really great mimic. I'd kind of like watch her play and I'd learn how to play it. Bad side of that was at the time, I really wasn't learning anything about reading music. When my father finally let me out of these lessons, I was just like really happy. The funny thing is that, when I look at the arc of that my life has taken, I get you will never know. But I mean, I often ask myself, I wonder if I would have found music sooner if he just left me alone. As the years have gone by, I'm so enamored with and fascinated with keyboard harmony. So it's everything to me. So it's funny. I spend at times, as much time, studying at the keyboard as I do, playing the guitar. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But the other part of it is, my father's a lyricist. A lot of people think he wrote the music, but he wrote the lyrics. Was a man of words, and words were important to him. And I think his fascination with words and writing was passed along to both my sister and me. In those days, it was very different. There were like, I don't know how many, I lost count, but if you start with guys like Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Peggy Lee and Julie London and Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald and Nat King Cole and there must have been a list of, 20, 30, really great singers. So when somebody's a songwriter like my father, you could hope that, your songs were going to be covered by 10, 15 people. Today, it's not like that. So Dad was always like having people send him LPs with his songs on them. But then there'd be times where we'd be listening to something and I'd say, wow, is that your song? He said, oh, no, that's, Rodgers and Hart, or that's Cole Porter, or that's any of the great, great songwriters. So even though I wanted to spend time with, you know, my friends and listening to, you know, our music at that time, because we're getting, you know, closer to, you know, the Beatles bursting on the scene. But, you know, we had tremendous R&B going on through all those years. It was, you know, really an incredible time. So lucky for me, I mean, I grew up really loving music, but also, you know, I loved lyrics. You know, Miles Davis said a great thing. You know, if you really want to play a ballad, you have to know the lyrics. It's funny for me, like, it's just a natural thing because I grew up listening to all those songs and, you know, hearing the words, learning the words to them. My dad was, I guess you could say, he was kind of an intuitive musician. He could play almost any song and always in the key of F. He had his way of doing things, and he could just hear, you know, the chord changes. And it's a funny thing because it's like with him, it's, you know, it's almost like all songs are the same with little changes to them because he could do it. I mean, the last really great composer he worked with was Jimmy Van Heusen. And before that, it was Julie Stein. There are a lot of them. After the piano lessons, so that took me to age 12. So that would be like to 1959. After that, we're still now 4 years before the Beatles, 3 years. And my friends and I, you know, we used to, you know, living where we lived, there a lot of the, you know, black music, African-American music, we couldn't get it, you know, in our little store. So when we, you know, one of us was old enough to get a, you know, driver's license, you know, we used to go downtown to these, you know, everybody knew the names of these record stores, and we go buy our 45s, you know, to buy James Brown and Sam and Dave, you name it, at this, you know, place. I think it was called Dolphins of Hollywood. You know, it was an incredible time, you know, collecting these, you know, amazing 45s, and really loved this music. So I was listening to that like all the time, you know, much more than you know, Elvis or stuff like that. You know, when the Beatles hit, all of a sudden, you know, the whole world went crazy. My friends had guitars, they had, you know, and they're sitting around together singing and doing these songs, and wow, I'd love to be a part of that. And so at the time, it looked to me like, well, how do I become a part of that? And stupid idiot that I am, I said, oh, the drums look easy. I'll do that. I went to my father and I said, Dad, can you, it's one of the few times I really asked him for something. I said, like, can you help me out? You have a lot of friends. Can you help me get a drum kit? And he said, well, I'll help you get some pieces together. Just because I, you know, he has friends, and I'd been to many sessions with him. I saw a lot of amazing things with him. You know, I wish I was a kid, so I don't remember a lot of, but I just remember the feeling and watching these great musicians play, you know, meeting people like Nelson Riddle and Billy May and all these incredible arrangers. And, but I just sat, you know, quiet. At the time, my friends and I, you know, we used to go and hear the surfing bands that were all, you know, kind of pre-Beatles. And one of the bands we used to go hear was a group called the Shantays, which had this one hit called Pipeline. Some things happened, and the Shantays lost their drummer. And of all things, I'd become friends with them by then. And they asked me to join the band, playing in this really great band and that I idolized. And I just felt so inadequate. But the next thing I know, you know, every weekend I'm leaving with them and I'm like touring somewhere, you know, whether it's upstate California or it was amazing. You know, it's like I'm just this little kid. And believe it or not, through the Shantays, the surfing band, you know, their guitar players were into all kinds of music. So they started listening to jazz all of a sudden. And one of the first, you know, one of the guys turned me on to Wes Montgomery. I got so into it that, you know, in those days, an LP cost $2. So at the time, you know, I would like, I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but, you know, I'd like go in my father's, I knew where he stored his money, and I'd steal a $20 bill, and I could go buy 10 LPs with that. So I bought, you know, Wes Montgomery's Movin' West album. And I remember I got home and I had, you know, earned enough money that I had a nice stereo, like, you know, real stereo with components and stuff. And I put on Moving West, and the first tune that comes on is Caravan. And Grady Tate was the drummer. And so I'm listening to this, and I almost felt like crying because it was so good. But it was an incredible moment because I realized, like, I'm never going to be able to play the drums like that. I can't play that. You know, I stink. This is, you know, I'm pathetic. Who's going to hire me? And, you know, I don't know that I could say I never picked up the sticks again, but I knew it was over. And at that point, this is going to really sound crazy too. I decided, of all things, I wanted to be a great jazz guitar player. I felt so unmusical on the drums that I had purchased a guitar just to have something so I could say EA and B7 to the guys and know what I was talking about. When I started out at UCLA, I was a psychology major. You know, I thought I was going to save the world and help people with their problems, my noble ambition. I did really terrible the first, you know, couple of years of these general psych courses, you know, psych 1A, psych 1B, in a class with like, you know, 500 people.
Man, I remember those days with 500 kids in your class in college. That was a real drag. But I thought it was very interesting that he started out with drums, because I actually initially wanted to be a drummer, but since I grew up in New York City, I couldn't do it. So I wanted to find out, how did he get to being such a great jazz guitarist?
So at 19 years old, I decide I'm going to be a great jazz guitar player. And I don't know what the hell happened. You know, I started like practicing really hard and studying. And, you know, one of the things you have to understand about that time, you know, there was no real book. There's no YouTube. There's no play along videos. There's no file sharing. There's no none of this stuff we have today was, you know, available then. And, you know, you had to do it yourself. I mean, I saw all my heroes. I saw Wes play. I saw Kenny Burrell play. I saw Jim Hall play. I saw Grant Green play. I mean, I saw, you know, those were my four favorites of the, you know, jazz guys. You know, I was just a complete groupie for Wes. I mean, I ended up becoming friends with him because I just was there all the time. And I just sit and watch him play. And I just, you know, I couldn't believe what I was seeing and hearing. You know, one other thing, you know, I know he's been a guest on your show, you know, when Larry Coryell hit the scene, he really changed everything. And the reason is that he was the first guy who was playing sort of, I guess you could say, like all the aspects that are the guitar. And he was the first one who was embraced by the critics. Like, now it was okay. You know, you can play some country music, you can play some rock. You know, you don't have to be, you know, sort of straight down the middle, have this big, round, warm tone, and just be a traditional jazz guitar player. You know, he opened the doors for everything that came afterward. And anybody who thinks any differently is not much of a student of those moments in history. And it was a really unique time because, you know, of course, these were the days of the hippies. And you really had a couple of, you know, seminal groups that were really about to change what everything was going to be. And, of course, you had Miles going electric. And then, you know, a lot of people don't think of it this way, but, you know, the Charles Lloyd quartet at the time with Jack DeJohnette, Ron McClure and Keith Jarrett, that was, you know, a very, you know, forward-looking group. And then you had, you know, the Gary Burton Quartet, Larry Coryell, Steve Swallow, and either Roy Haynes or Bobby Moses. So these things were hugely important, and they were really, you know, blurring the lines of genres. You know, if somebody, you know, people want things to be pure, but that was over. Nothing was going to be pure again. But I think the Mahavishnu Orchestra, you know, just put John in this whole other level. He was the fusion guitarist of all time, and our fastest guitar in the West, all this stuff, because the Mahavishnu Orchestra had a sound. And it was, you know, a sound. And it went through the first record, the second record, you know, and that's, it's such a huge thing. You know, needless to say, you know, the rest is history. I mean, because this spawned, you know, decades of all these, you know, great young guitar players. I think I knew that the records that I loved the most were all coming from New York. You know, in L.A., the best, you know, to me, you know, jazz group we had at the time was the Jazz Crusaders. And that was before they became the Crusaders. I mean, they were, you know, a jazz group. You know, I enjoyed seeing them a lot, and I loved their music. You know, I found it, you know, very singable, and I could, you know, figure it out. And my father, you know, he had a lot of friends who were musicians, and one of the guys he knew, you know, from the pits of Broadway shows and stuff, was this drummer percussionist named Stanley Krell. And Stanley, you know, called my father and said, listen, this kid, he's a student of mine, his name's David Friedman, he's a great vibes player, and he's coming out to LA to play the troubadour with this folk singer, Tim Buckley. He said, I think Steve should meet David. I connected with David. We, you know, had a little jam session one day. We liked each other and, you know, enjoyed playing together. And so he invited me to come back to New York for a summer. I think it was summer of 69, just to see what it was like. And so, you know, he basically, you know, showed me what New York is. And I went around with him. We had a gig all summer, but, you know, he was doing lots of sessions, and I went with him. Once I went with Stanley Krell, the same guy I mentioned, was playing in the pit of Cabaret for years. Maybe the original one with Liza Minnelli. Stanley brings me down into the bases. You know, I sit down here. He said, you got to be quiet. Don't say anything. You know, it's a really cramped little space. And as it gets closer to showtime, you know, the musicians start to amble in. And as I'm looking across at the music stands, and the music stands are all littered with Swedish porn magazines. As the musicians come in, you know, a lot of them, they've played this show, you know, 1,000 times. So they're, for example, you know, they have their trumpet, you know, in one hand. They're not even looking at the music, and they're flipping the pages of these, whether it's a porn magazine or reading, you know, War and Peace or something, or a newspaper. You're supposed to be serious about this stuff. But, you know, they had memorized everything. They didn't have to look at anything. But the most shocking thing that day was, look over to the right, and there's Art Farmer playing third trumpet in the pit of Cabaret. Wait a minute. That really doesn't make any sense. That's one of my idols. Art Farmer plays with Jim Hall. How is this possible? But, you know, there's this unseen world where, you know, guys have to make a living. After that summer, I knew that if I was ever going to see if I could do this, I had to come to New York. And so, yeah, I went back to UCLA, finished my last quarter, and then, you know, more or less moved to New York in January of 1970.
Yeah, it's amazing how many great players there are that do jingles and do all of this side work that you don't realize. I remember being an assistant engineer in jingles in New York City and seeing like Hiram Bullock come in. But then Steve was hired to play guitar in the Brecker Brothers.
You know, what happened was as the Brecker Brothers band was, you know, starting to do well, but we had a lot of, you know, internal problems because some of us in the band wanted, you know, us to be a great band of instrumentalists. And others wanted us to be, you know, somehow a great R&B band, which we were not. I mean, yes, the music was, you know, very funky in its way and had R&B underpinnings to it. But, you know, to really do R&B, you need somebody who's a really great singer. Randy didn't write songs like that. I didn't. Mike didn't. Don didn't. So I got this amazing opportunity to record as a leader, thanks to... it started with Bobby Colombi, who was, you know, the drummer in the original Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And so Bobby liked what I was doing. He liked a couple of my tunes. And he brought me to Bob James, who was going to become the head of A&R at Columbia Records. You know, Bob was unbelievably, you know, nice to me, and he believed in me, and he signed me. And that started that series of records in 77 with Tightrope, the Blue Man and Arrows. But the funny thing was, is, you know, everything just turned upside down for me. You know, when I came here, I guess I had three guitars. I had some kind of, you know, Gibson Super 400, obviously influenced by Larry Coryell. And then I had somebody in LA that said, well, you're going to need a Les Paul. So I had one of those, but I never really played it and ended up selling it. And then I had a couple of acoustic guitars. I had a steel string, six string by this California guitar maker who was great. And I think I had his only acoustic 12 string too. So that was all I had. And at a certain point, I realized, like, well, wait a second. Nobody wants to hear me playing this, you know, Super 400. Everybody's playing, you know, solid bodies now. And so New York seemed to be, you know, filled with guys, and they were all playing Telecasters. So, you know, I wanted to, you know, work, make a living. So I bought one and went through, you know, a transition of trying to, everybody was trying to, you know, make the hottest possible pickups. You know, my Telecaster was, I guess you could say, it was hot rodded to, you know, almost not sound like a Telecaster. But when the 80s dawned, I mean, the heavy fusion era was over. And Columbia just, they dropped all their artists. You know, it was like a house cleaning. You wouldn't have believed it. What they did was they dropped all of us and they started putting out these LPs. I think they called them the best of. Here I am. I've only done three records, and all of a sudden I have a best of Steve Kahn. I mean, wow, how could that be? I haven't done anything. They call it the brown paper bag series because if you looked at it sort of from far away, they all looked like, you know, brown paper bags with a picture on them. You know, I signed with Columbia, and I thought, well, this is great. So I'm going to be here like Miles Davis. I'll be here for 25 years, and welcome home, Stevie. You know, here you are. Have a nice life and career. And then 3 years is over. You know, 1 minute, you know, everything is great and people are telling you how much they love you and all this stuff. And the next minute, nobody's answering your phone calls anymore. So when it hit the 80s, man, I just felt like I was completely lost. And Warren Bernhardt was my neighbor. Living in the apartment building and the apartment next door to me. Warren and I, we would stay up all night talking about life and music and everything. And he was telling me stories about his life, things, you know, I'd known him for years, but things I'd never really known. You know, we'd be up talking till the sun came up. And I think in many ways, you know, Warren really saved my life in a certain way, because the things that developed from those conversations, they were so meaningful to me. Yeah, I'm basically, you know, when someone says to you, man, don't worry, you'll get through this. And he says, I've been through phases like this many, many times where, you know, you feel like you stink and everything's horrible. And you get through it. But I mean, of course, I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel for nothing. After that, I put the Telecaster away and I almost never played it again. I said, I'm going to start all over again. And I got out my 335 and I got rid of all of my pedals and just said, I'm going to plug into the amp, a little reverb, and that's going to be it. But in the meantime, I went back to all the music that had originally inspired me to play. You know, next thing I know, I'm just practicing all the time. And Warren starts to hear me like through the wall. This was just on acoustic guitar. And he said, so what are you doing? And I said, I'm just like, you know, working on all these Monk tunes. He says, wow, man. He says, I never heard somebody play Monk on a guitar like that. I said, really? And he says, no. And as it kept going, the months went by. He says, man, he says, if you don't record yourself, I'm going to kill you. And I said, you're kidding. He says, no, you have to do it. And so this was the first time that I ever took my own money. I worked something out with an engineer in a studio, and I went in one weekend and recorded what became Evidence. It was kind of a strange concept for a record. Like, side one was five ballads, and side two was this medley of nine Monk tunes strung together. It was just something I believed in. And at the time, to do that, it cost me $6,000, which was killing me. You know, like, oh my God. But in the end, that album, somehow Steve Backer, who was the head of Ariston Novus, sort of their more serious jazz wing, he picked it up. He said, I love this, and let's do it. You know, it's a miracle. I mean, it's a real miracle. And that was the only time I've paid for so many of my records out of my own pocket. I lost count a long time ago. Evidence was the only one where I actually got the money back. The only other thing I had on Arista was the Corey L. Khan duet album, but that was from like 74 or something. I mean, one of the things that happened was, you know, when we formed the band that became known as Eyewitness in 1981 with Anthony Jackson, Steve Jordan, and Manolo Badrena, this was, again, like where I sort of went back to square one sound-wise, and we just started like jamming together. And after a couple of those jam sessions at Steve Jordan's loft, I called this Japanese promoter. His name was George Braun, who just recently passed away. It was really, really sad. And I told him, I said, George, I said, I have something. And I told him who was in it. And I said, I don't know what it is we're doing, but I said, I'd love to record it before we find out what we're doing. And he actually said, okay, I'll make it happen. And so we, you know, called some people in Japan. And the next thing I know, you know, we're going in to record, you know, for a weekend or something. And we did the first record, Eyewitness. And I wouldn't say it caused a sensation. That's not true, really. But there was a certain small number of people, including music writers, etc., who just loved what it was, the openness of the texture and the kind of freewheeling feeling to all of it. Suddenly, that band, we were never able to really tour in the U.S. We could play in New York and we could play in Japan. But I think those three recordings we did with that group, it caused people to see me differently. People started to see me as a creative player. And so we did those three records. Then there was this, that was like 81, 82, 83. Then there was this, you know, kind of absence of, I didn't know what to do or how to do it. And so by some miracle in 86, Joe Zawinul called me to join what was going to become Weather Update, you know, after Wayne left Weather Report. I thought, well, okay, this is going to be, I'll be with, you know, Joe for the next 10 years of my life. Well, we won 7-week tour, and that was the end of it, because it was, you know, too expensive for him to, you know, maintain a band with, you know, Peter Erskine and Victor Bailey. So that was over in 86. Then I started, like, listening to all these rehearsal cassettes I had from the Eyewitness days. That's in 88. And I went, oh, my God, there's some really good music here. And so I called up Anthony Manolo. I said, if I finish this music and put it together, will you guys record with me, you know, one more time? And they said, sure. And so we got Dave Weckl, a young Dave Weckl, who, you know, not too many people knew about then. And we go in, again, on my nickel, and we recorded Public Access, which I ended up placing with GRP, but not after a song and a dance you wouldn't have believed. But they put the record out. And this record, you know, was probably my best, well, I don't know, I guess I could say the best-selling record, but it doesn't really mean anything in terms of, like, did I get any money from it? No. That record was distributed all over the world. And people, you know, Manolo always used to tell me, he said, man, you wouldn't believe how many people love these records that we've done. You know, because he's more, you know, he was then, you know, communicating more with the Caribbean and, you know, South America, Spain. And I had no idea what the impact of these records was until, because, you know, a lot of people see Manolo as kind of a crazy guy, but he's really not. And he was really telling me the truth. And but I didn't understand. It was just because, you know, GRP was very powerful and they could, you know, get your record into places in South America where that, you know, nothing else I'd ever done had gotten there, but this one did.
Boy, that's the truth. It's amazing how much distribution matters. And also back in those days with physical distribution, you could only get in certain places with Muscle Power. Now, of course, I always ask everybody their setup and their guitar rig.
My setup, my rig, if you can call it that, it really hasn't changed too much in the last, 10 years. I mean, what I ended up doing was, because I had, you know, some really, at least for me, pretty serious back problems. And so carting around the amps and that I had was just impossible for me. So I ended up on the recommendation of John Abercrombie, because we've always, you know, maintained a wonderful friendship. He recommended these little amps called the Walter Woods amps. I don't know, it's like a small Amazon.com box for a couple of CDs. It's about that size, but it's got, you know, I think 200 watts of power. And I reduced everything down to that. My basic sound has always been this one goofy, I stumbled upon it too, this Ibanez chorus pedal, but it's called a DCF-10. And that goes out to two Marshall bottoms, 2x12s, not 4x12s. The funny thing is I'm playing with this big, clean sound, but I'm actually playing really loud. But it's not distorted. I mean, I realize, you know, you wrote me, then you said you play Sancudoville, and that's one of the few songs in these, you know, past years that I've recorded with some kind of overdrive, but it happens to be, you know, a rarity. I don't do that often, but I would like to believe that when I do it, people say, well, that's a really great sound. Why don't you play like that more often? It's really funny. I mean, I don't know whether it was Bill Connors or Alan Holsworth, because I've been friends with those guys too. And I remember they were saying to me, he said, oh man, when you're playing with overdrive, you never put your chorus pedal on. There's no, it's like science to them. You know, it's like, no, that's completely wrong. Don't do that. So that's one of the few times like I shut the chorus pedal off, and I just use this, a TS-10 or TSI, you know, the tube screamer. There's a particular setting that I like. It's in combination with playing loud. You know, you can't I don't believe, you know, get a really great sound like tiptoeing around. You got to, as they say, you know, you got to throw some air. The most sophisticated thing I use in the recordings is this DVP Korg DVP-1 harmonizer. And when you're listening to the records, at least since 2005, but Public Access had it on it too. It sounds like, my own mini psychedelic big band. But it's really a concept I got from playing with Zawinul. He used to, when he was playing the synthesizer, the Prophet, you know, when we were playing together, he'd be playing something. And then all of a sudden he's playing this polyphonic stuff, but I'm watching his hand and it's one hand. He's not playing chord voicings. So I had become really good friends with his keyboard tech. And I said, is there anything that can do that on a guitar? And he says, well, there's only one thing I can think of. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, the DVP-1 by Korg. And so we had, through Weather Update, you know, we had an endorsement with Korg. And so I guess I bought one, but it, you know, cost or something. And the next thing, I'm sitting here, you know, programming in my voicings. And what that particular device will do is it'll take the notes you're playing and then harmonize it. Usually what I do is have the notes harmonized underneath the principal note. And you can have as many as four voicings. So you can play these wild chordal sounds. you know, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you can hear it on a lot of the music I send you. The thing is, like, you know, if you listen to, you know, Michael Brecker's iwi playing, you know, you hear a lot of that kind of stuff there too, except, you know, the iwi can kind of randomly move notes within a tonality. So what I do with the DVP-1 is it has, you know, four banks of sounds. So I'll have like something that I'd call like a major bank, a dominant seventh bank, a altered dominant seventh bank, and a minor bank. And so each bank has eight sounds in it. So like, let's say I play a little line using sound 41. Well, if I put it in bank hold and I have it off to my right, I take a breath and I push eight, sound 48 comes up and it's slightly different. And it sounds like I'm actually doing something. And I guess I am, because I know what each of those sounds are, but it makes it less monotonous than just saying, oh, he's just playing, you know, one setting for 10 minutes.
It was a real pleasure talking to Steve. He had so much information, which was great. Steve really paid his dues through the years, and I always felt he was underrated. And he had some wonderful stories as well. So here's some downtime from the Blue Man album from 1978.
Hi, this is guitarist Steve Kahn, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT 89.5 FM, the best instrumental music on the Space Coast.